The Monday Morning Tech Chat Show is brought to you by Audible. Audible is, of course, the premier audiobook service, perfect for folks who want their books read to them. Thousands and thousands of titles to choose from in all genres, sci-fi, fantasy, biographies, history, thrillers, mysteries, and more. We've got a great offer for listeners on this podcast, 2 free audiobooks when you sign up. And those books are yours to keep even if you decide to cancel your Audible subscription, which is $14.95 a month and gives you a free book every month of your choosing, as well as some other fun perks. Membership has its privileges. Hit up bit.ly/geekbookclub to start your free trial and get those 2 free books on lock. Once again, bit.ly/geekbookclub. And now, let's get into the show. All right. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I am Juan Carlos Bagnell, some gadget guy, the SGG of this horribly named podcast series. And the QA, of course, stands for question and answer. I like to host my shows on a Monday. We've got the week, we've got all this tech news that we can kind of dig into, but I like to take a little time as we sort out our feelings. And then Mondays, we come here and we have some kind of interactive discussion about the top news that's happening. I'm already seeing a crazy live chat lining up right now. Boeing by Tree of Palms, Michael Upchurch, Kyle Ruggles, Vazicose 8, JMX Warrior, Heike, Gabaletta. I think I saw Q3 Becker, LFA Reviews, Walter Vincier, Al Spokey? I'm probably not pronouncing your handle right. Aditi Anil, Sean Diggs Tech, Arthur Lee 525. Good morning. Happy Monday. Welcome to the beginning of another awesome tech week. We've got a ton of stuff to get through. I'm going to try. I say this every podcast, but I'm genuinely going to try to not make this podcast 3 hours long. I've been going a little longer. I like spending time with you fine folks out there. I think we need to rein it in just a bit. And I'm going to have a lot to tease too, because we've got a whole slate of videos kind of queuing up, and then we've got some big announcements and some coverage for some devices coming down the pipe, and we're gonna have to see how all this stuff fits together, where it all lines up. But one of the things that's gonna help keep me on track is not blowing out my voice on a 3-hour podcast. So I definitely want to Boeing by. I like the energy on the dual screen boss man. That's where we should probably start. We definitely got to clear some housekeeping, because last week was a surprisingly busy week. And this week's looking like it's also going to have a lot of stuff to talk about, too. So let's jump right in. Let me get this out of the way here. And we're at 9:03. What's my over-under? What's my over-under for housekeeping? I'm going to say 10 minutes. I'm going to get housekeeping done by 9:14 Pacific Daylight Time. That is my goal. Let's do this. Boom. I got that big boss man energy. I'm taking a page out of my own book. All right. Screen sharing here. Number one, I feel like this is probably going to become a topic I'm going to revisit yearly from now on, is bias. Bias in reviewing and what our expectations of a smartphone reviewer should be. The title of this article is My Phone Bias Part 2. It's not about slamming popular phones. Just the weekly heads up. Every article, every news story, every topic that we're going to be covering, you can catch in the show notes, somegadgetguy.com. And this is also where I've got all of my housekeeping stuff here. That's what we're talking about right now. So, My Phone Bias. I think it's pretty clear that I have built a particular reputation for a certain style of coverage. And I totally appreciate why people who kind of come to my YouTube channel typically have like one of two reactions. It's either like, oh, I hadn't even considered this from a less popular brand, or you're totally a shill for that brand. How much did they pay you? What's funny is like, I think A number one, the company most folks would associate with my channel would be LG, but I get the exact same comments on Sony, on BlackBerry, on the Pixel, on OnePlus. And again, it's that kind of toxic YouTube commenter mentality. So the OnePlus 8 launches, and I just get tagged in a bunch of tweets from fans of Jonathan Morrison and MKBHD. And it's like they were proactive. Yeah, like especially once the iPhone SE was announced, which we're going to be talking about in the second half of this podcast. It was like immediate. Oh, well, we know what some gadget guy is going to say about this. Mur, 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 mur. So again, I feel it's important to clear the air. No human is a machine. Everyone has a perspective, a preference, and I feel like those reviewers out there who are kind of honest and a bit more upfront about these are the features I like and this is why I like them produce better commentary. You know exactly where Danny Wingard is coming from. When he starts doing camera tech, the dude knows cameras. So you trust what he has to say and why he values certain features and why he's concerned about certain compromises. So I try to put that sort of commentary up front so you know where I'm coming from. And then also, you know what to follow and what to disregard. Like if you don't really care about the kind of audio tech that I'm talking about on a smartphone, you know that that's not going to be a valuable part of the phone experience for you. You kind of know it's not really going to be something you care about in one of my reviews. But that's why I feel like that kind of visibility is so important in the review space. It's why we kind of grade and rate things and why certain devices get sort of special consideration over others. But if you're not clear, or if you're trying to claim that you're somehow robotically objective and you can perfectly free your emotions from the review space, then I feel like those reviewers tend to game YouTube metrics more than consistently reviewing products. So whatever is going to be most popular and do well for YouTube ad revenue becomes their preference. And that to me becomes a very toxic conversation in the gadget review space. Here, let me and I'm seeing a lot of comments about different reviewers in the iPhone SE. Please hold on to those comments because I want to have a little bit more of an interactive discussion in the second half of the podcast. I have a lot of thoughts on the iPhone SE 2020. Next up, speaking of phones, again, if my review channel were built on maximizing my YouTube ad revenue, I'd probably not be making videos like these. Because I really liked the Pixel 4, the end of 2019. I think it got kind of a raw deal by a lot of reviewers out there. I think it's a perfectly competitive premium smartphone with just a different list of pros and cons. But one of those cons, and I think no one would fight me on this, is that a comparative battery performance on the Pixel 4 was a bit disappointing for a lot of folks out there. So, the folks over at Zero Lemon have a big chunk of a battery case to help. They took pity on the Pixel 4, and even though it was a less popular phone, these types of accessories are super critical for the ecosystem of a gadget. If someone has a hard time getting a case for a phone, they're probably not going to buy from that phone manufacturer in the future. So, ecosystem, seeing that there are a few companies out there supporting the Pixel 4 well is critical for that conversation on a phone like the Pixel. And hopefully we see this continued investment in good accessories for this next generation of Pixel devices. They're really unique offerings in the Android ecosystem. So I hope the Pixel still gets some love from other manufacturers. Moving right along, one of my favorite audio manufacturers One More sent over some Bluetooth speakers. This is the One More Bluetooth speaker. Oh, the full product name is One More Portable Bluetooth Speaker. One More is not very good at naming their products, but they make great audio kit. And where I was a bit skeptical about the brand when I first started seeing reviews on it, this is becoming one of my favorite audio tech brands to cover. Aditi Anil with the great dad joke, Juan Namor. So when I'm called a One More shill, we can link it. And it's like, this is the Juan More from One More. Juan More review on a One More product. But no, seriously, these are, here, I've got it right over here. When I saw the press photos, I thought this was going to be smaller. So this is the One More speaker that I'm holding up here. It is larger than I thought it was, that I thought it was going to be. And we've got a number of those, like, $40 to $80 single tube, you know, like the UE. I think the perfect example of that trend is the UE Wonderboom. But those little kind of tubular Bluetooth speakers, One More has an option that can also dual pair. So you can get two of them. You can link them in stereo or make them dual mono. And then I maybe have a promo code that can save people a ton of cash on a One More Bluetooth speaker, which you can find in the support page on SomeGadgetGuy.com. Right here. Support SomeGadgetGuy. And that brings us to my last... second to last. This is the biggie. I had a little fun with the video. And this is... let me go add a screen share here. One of the reasons why I have such a problem with the overly aggressive review schedule that reviewers put into phones. Like, if I can't talk about it the day it comes out with a full review after 24 hours of use, the YouTube algorithm absolutely savages a video that took a little bit longer to produce. Like, my V60 review, not doing as well as previous LG phone reviews have done because I took my time to produce an actual review. I think I was 4 weeks into using that phone when I finally put out that 28-minute review. This video, I put out a video called Rock Two Screens Like a Boss, you know, V60 Dual Screen Pro Tips. I would not have been able to put out this video the week that this phone came out. This video took the time to actually use the phone to find all of these little tips and tricks that LG doesn't document. So it's things like, hold on, let me see if I can actually show this on my V60. So, this is terrible audio podcasting, but, you know, you've got the second display on, and if you want to disable it, you would normally go through this fiddly little menu thing and turn it off. But there's a double tap action that turns the V60 display on and off. That's not documented anywhere in the V60 reviewer guides or in the V60 manual or on LG's website. You can't make a video like this and have like some really great, like, man, these are power user tips until you've used the phone for a while. So I tried to get this lit up. I was sitting down and I was going to just record a regular straight, oh, and if you do this, you can do that. And here's a tip for the pen. And here's how you do these fun things on the V60. And I was about a third of the way into shooting it. And I was bored of myself. I was like, I was annoyed with my own video presentation while I was recording it. And, I scrapped it, I immediately reset, and I came up with, I think it's going to be a reoccurring character on the review channel, is this lit up fake hip-hop power user insult machine. Don't go opening the screen to answer your phone calls. You want to be looking like some Karen out there. Thought you knew. I think I'm going to have to bring that guy back for future pro tip videos, because like, it allowed me to get through this video so much faster, and I'm not sitting there and like detailing every pro tip. It's just, this exists, do it. This exists, do it. And I kind of liked that energy. The video has been getting a lot of positive reactions. The comments have been phenomenal. So far, three people have said that it's childish and immature. One person said, this is a terrible way to convince people to subscribe to your channel. I just got another comment saying, what was it? This is way too hyped and it's super annoying and stop yelling at me. But everyone else, aside from those five comments, everyone else seems to have enjoyed some kind of shift. So I need to make this a clearer distinction. Power user guy needs to be more like Terry Crews, you know, lit up aggressive aggro. The other, I'm going to have like shill reviewer, and that's Gadget Guy. And I'm going to have to make him, I think, a little bit more chill. Hey, y'all, it's your boy, it's Gadget Guy. I'm sort of over everything tech, but I keep this chill so that you know what's going on and I can tell you what's most popular, as opposed to Power User Guy, who's like, do this thing and get that done. Hook it up, you know? So I'm going to have to see if I can make a clearer distinction between the gimmick characters on my YouTube channel. Aditya Anel. Oh, wow. Three personas in Juan's body. There are a lot of voices going on in each of our heads. I just only have the one YouTube channel to showcase them all. But anyway, that was the big video. The reason why I'm kind of also bringing this up with that frustration over YouTube's algorithm is I would not have been able to make this video the week I got the phone. I would not have known about all of these tips and tricks the week I got it. In fact, the week I got it, I wasn't even sure if we had real proper stylus support. That still hadn't been fully disclosed what the compatibility was by LG. But because this video is now a couple weeks out from the launch, we're in OnePlus territory and iPhone SE territory. The algorithm has already sort of destroyed this video too. So, you know, whenever we're trying to put together cool content, if it's not getting shared, then, it's not really going to have much of a life on YouTube. And that's what's kind of frustrating is you take the time and you take the energy and you put together something that's like, I still feel, even for being as gimmicky a video as it is, it's commentary that I don't think a lot of people were even aware that this phone could do these things. But, the traffic, you go into the video knowing that the traffic is going to be just murked by what's going on with YouTube software. So that's everything on Some Gadget Guy. I also had a quick shout out. I helped produce. I unfortunately didn't get to go as hands-on as I'd want to. But over on Newegg Studios, we got hands-on with the new Gigabyte Aero 17 HDR, which is just an absolutely stunning laptop. Top-of-the-line Intel and NVIDIA specs. I'm mostly doing the VO, unfortunately, because of the situation we find ourselves in. I didn't get to play with this machine as much as I would have otherwise been able to. But the Newegg Ninjas shot some gorgeous B-roll of one of the slickest laptops I think I've ever seen. So that was a fun video to help co-produce, even though I was stuck at home for most of the production. Oh, I can drop the link for that in the live chat. And I have gone long on housekeeping, dang it. But by 4 minutes, we are through the housekeeping block. As previously mentioned, all of the stories we're talking about, all of the links, all of the production that I've already produced over the last week, you'll find it all on somegadgetguide.com and in the show notes for this week's episode. But we've got some other news to jump into, some other stuff to check out. And again, like I said, I really want to dig in a little bit for iPhone SE 2020, OnePlus 8, questions, comments, concerns. Save some of that chatter for the second half. Please make sure that you're still jumping in. And Gabaletta absolutely called it, 14 minutes on housekeeping. I was shooting for 10. But I had to tangent and sidetrack my own. I'm my own worst enemy when it comes to talking too much. So I want to jump into some news, and first off, I just want to kick out, this is a regularly featured topic on the podcast. I haven't followed up on it in a while, and that's gambling mechanics in video games and our responsibility as a tech community to properly rate the content of our video games. In previous episodes of the podcast, my stance has always been, I don't want a government and I don't want censorship, like even internal censorship of game mechanics and game content. I feel like even though the ratings boards can sometimes be suspect, like I don't really trust the MPAA as a body to properly rate the content of movies. But it's the best solution we have outside of the government coming in to censor movies. And I feel the same way about the ESRB. The ESRB is the ratings board for electronic entertainment. So we get those game ratings, you know, E for everyone and AO for adults only, mature audiences, et cetera, et cetera. My stance on things like real money gambling mechanics and video games is to make them adults only. As it doesn't matter if you've got a cutesy cartoon dragon, as soon as there is a random number generating event, which is tied to some kind of real world monetary value, I feel like that instantly should put it out of the recommendation for games for kids. When you go through the family games and the kids games on Google Play, for almost all of our smartphone and tablet games, it is horrifically insidious how paywalled, how interrupted, how you have no control over the ads which are served to kids. And then all of the creative hoop jumping. So it used to be a loot box was like the nastiest thing ever. So you'd pay money and you'd get a box and it was a random number slot machine to what would go inside. When loot boxes started getting negative press, the games industry shifted to, well, what you're doing is you're buying gems, and then you take those gems and you throw them into a wood chipper, and maybe something cool will come out the other side. But it's not a loot box. Oh, no, 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 no. You do not spend money on a box. You spend money on in-game currency, and then the in-game currency is used to facilitate a random event. See, that's totally different than a loot box. And I still feel like some of the worst offenders of that are the family-friendly franchise games. I was a hardcore Marvel Future Fight player. I mean, for years. That was like the primary game I was showing off in my Android reviews up through my term at Pocket Now. Was like, man, if this phone can play Marvel Future Fight well, this is a pretty powerful gaming phone. And from that time to now, the game has gotten increasingly random number generating dependent. So you grind for months. And I mean, literally, you grind in the game for weeks and weeks to accrue in-game materials, and then you upgrade your characters through random events. So you just dump all of this material into a slot machine, and you hope that you can tier 3 your Captain America. So, and it's beyond just pay to win. I don't necessarily have a philosophical issue with pay to win if you pay for what you get. You know, if there's like if there's a golden gun, you know, like taking it back to N64 days. If there's a golden gun and it costs you $20 and now you can one-shot kill 360-degree no-scope everyone on the map from impossible distances, fine. But I paid $20 and I got the golden gun, and now the game is broken. But if that's what the developers want to do, that's great. What is more concerning is the slot machine mechanic, where you lose, you lose, you lose, you lose. You're getting frustrated, you're amped, you're emotional, and then you get that win, and you get an even bigger dopamine hit in your brain because of the win. I'm concerned about grown-ups who fall prey to that kind of mechanic. The whales in Marvel Future Fight, when I left the game, if you do the math on how they were ranking up characters, there were people who were regularly spending around $5,000 to $10,000 a month on Marvel Future Fight to stay at the top of the leaderboards of that game. Whales want a whale? Sure, that's fine. But I really don't want to be introducing those types of mechanics to kids and teaching them that that's how gaming works. So, this is a positive step. It's not completely sufficient. I don't believe it fully encapsulates the situation or fully corrects for the situation in gaming. But this is coming by way of digital trends. A couple news outlets actually did pick up this story. I just wished it had gotten a bit more attention. ESRB to introduce new ratings label for games with loot boxes. And from the article, games... Oh, wait, who wrote this? From Tyler Treese over at Digital Trends. Games that include loot boxes and other types of microtransactions with random chance elements will now come with a warning on physical copies of games. The Entertainment Software Association announced that its regulatory board will begin adding a label that reads in-game purchases includes random items on offending titles. The ESRB began notifying consumers about certain interactive elements in games in April 2018. Originally, the two labels games could receive were for in-game purchases and user interaction. The rating board will now introduce this third label to add transparency about in-game purchases. So this is not completely sufficient. I still feel that if the game progression hinges in any way on slot machine mechanics, that needs to affect the rating. Right now, we rate games for story content. If there's grisly or bloody or gory storytelling elements, or more adult themes, then that changes the rating. Games aren't quite like movies, though. The actual play mechanics can impact the maturity or the audience for the game. And this is one of those situations where if the actual game mechanics hinge on some type of gambling mechanic, then I feel it needs to be rated like any other type of gambling. There's a reason why, Vegas won't let you on the casino floor until you're 21. Because liquor and dopamine and gambling go together really well in separating people from their money. So, I'm still calling this a positive step. I feel like this was an important recognition, probably 2 years too late, because we're still hung up on loot boxes, even though those aren't the same kind of concern that they used to be. We've all moved on to other types of predatory microtransactions and new types of pay-to-win mechanics. But at least now we're having some kind of labeled conversation. What I would really hope is that these additional labels on physical copies of games find their way into digital distribution. I don't know about you all out there, but I'm not going to stores to buy physical copies of games these days. And when I can help it, I'm not ordering the physical boxed versions of games. I'm just going straight to downloading the titles on my PS4 and on my PC and Epic Games Launcher and Steam and Good Old Games and Humble Bundle. I honestly can't remember the last time I bought a box that had a sticker on it that told me what the game's rating was. And I'm seeing some other people, Aditya Anil, hashtag some respect social distancing guy. Yeah, it's kind of critical for me. A lot of people are saying, this is an EA thing, or no, Activision did this too. I feel like this is a pervasive issue for how we post-monetize any game. And unfortunately, I would point to EA as paving the road. I don't think that's too controversial a statement to say a number of these of the most aggressive versions of this mechanic came from EA. But the entire industry saw EA making money on it. And just like smartphones and Apple, some bad ideas were profitable. So now the rest of the industry sort of followed with similar versions, maybe a little less predatory, maybe a little less aggressive. But we've seen the entire industry kind of latch on to some of these ideas. I think some developers are walking back from that. Even EA in some of their more recent titles have walked back from some of that. But it's still a conversation we need to remain vigilant on. So, you know, I'm going to keep revisiting whether or not we're seeing this, because we keep getting really close to legislation. And like I said at the beginning of this segment, I don't want politicians deciding what mechanics can go into games and what content can go into games. If we ever could point to a more out-of-touch group of individuals to weigh in on gaming content, it would be our current elected officials. And so we need to, we as consumers, we as members of the tech community, need to be hyper-vigilant that we don't get to that point. And it's beyond just voting with our dollars. It's making our voices heard. It's even just like writing a letter to your favorite game developers. Send them an email. When they hear this communication, or when they see these types of topics brought up on like Reddit or in other social media, it seems to have an impact on the longer term future of this type of game development. From where we were in the darkest days of FIFA style mechanics at EA pivoting, and their more recent Star Wars title, not as terrible as their first foray into Star Wars and loot boxes. So it's slow. It's never as fast an adjustment as we'd want it to be, but this stuff resonates, and we can have some kind of positive change on this industry. And Matt Tyler, EA made billions on loot boxes. EA made more on loot boxes than they did on selling the games that had the loot boxes. It's a problem that as long as people buy it, they will keep doing it, which is why I feel like there needs to be some kind of other additional pressure if the ESRB wants to get serious about maintaining a positive image for gaming. That one solution would be rating games based on the monetary content. Sentinel 909. It's an industry thing. As I mentioned above, I work in the gaming industry, and that whole mentality has just recently started to let up. And again, I think consumers have been so conscious about the phrase loot boxes that it's becoming a toxic idea. It's smart for game developers to start walking away from that. From Goran Petrovic, what is the solution to make a game that's interesting, satisfying to play, and no manipulation? So first of all, and he's asking this to Sentinel 909, and there's some back and forth conversation going on, but just to weigh in, to mansplain to all of you folks on there on my own podcast, I feel like there are some really good examples of community goodwill and what makes for a profitable experience. Love it or hate it, I feel like the seasons, the shift to seasons for a game like Fortnite shows one potential consumer-focused version of how you can post-monetize or make a free-to-play game without it being overly gouging on the consumer. One of my favorite developers to bring up, one of my favorite titles to bring up in this conversation is Path of Exile. Now, Path of Exile has a much smaller community base to support, but that community base, the additional transactions in Path of Exile, Path of Exile is a Diablo-style dungeon looter clone, and it's free to play, but you pay a couple small transactions to make the game a little bit more livable. A good sort of a good clone of that on Android is Anima, A-N-I-M-A, which you've been seeing in some of my recent phone reviews. I paid the developers at Anima, and I paid the developers at Path of Exile a little bit of money to unlock just a few quality of life improvements. So, like, I can carry more stuff. I have more storage when I go back to town. I mean, just a few little things like that. And it didn't cost me a lot, but that was enough to kind of help the developers keep the lights on. And again, depending on the community size, I feel like mechanics like that you can get into the game. You can play and beat the game for free. It just takes a little bit more creative juggling of resources. Or you can kick us $5. And here, now you've got, a chest that you can just stock stuff in and store things in. And it makes your life a little bit easier. I feel like we can start pivoting on some of this stuff in ways that it's a lot more accessible to the community. The flip side of this is I think games just need to be more expensive. And I hate that I'm saying this in the worst possible time for a lot of consumers out there. Everything that's going on with the situation. But the notion that a AAA title is always going to be $60 is not sustainable.
Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on rglowingrectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
And it's actually just not true. I mean, you look at all of the launch shenanigans that companies play. Oh yeah, $59.99, but if you want these characters and you want this DLC pass and you want this season pass and you want these upgrades and you want this character skin, you need to buy the mega cool tin box steel edition, and that's going to be $120. I kind of feel like gamers also just need to accept the idea that games have gotten significantly more expensive to produce at that top tier, that AAA tier. And our currency is not as valuable as it was 10, 20 years ago. So I know that there's a psychological block at $59.99, but to make these games more profitable, that's why we see so many add-on mechanics past $59.99. It's because the game doesn't really cost $59.99 for them to recoup their investment on just the game. And I feel like this is another longer term conversation that the industry needs to have with gamers out there. And I'm seeing Jude Campbell and Evans Breming on Periscope. Hey, watching the show on Periscope. Hey, welcome. Goran Petrovic talking to Sentinel 909, Grim Dawn, Diablo, Torchlight, Path of Exile are all quite similar. Again, I love those dungeon looters. I get real bad if I've got an addiction or an obsessive compulsive issue with games. It's games like that. All right, moving right along. I just need to bring this up. We've been covering a lot of topics on this show the last 2 weeks. Some very serious conversations about things like conspiracy theories. And how do we undo some of the damage from misinformation campaigns? And how do we reach out to people that have been sucked into kind of cultish thinking? Things like Flat Earth, and more recently, linking 5G towers to the spread of disease. You know, the nastiest 5G conspiracy theories pointing to, and to the point where 5G towers have been vandalized and burned. You know, to me, this is a scary and insidious attack on telecommunications infrastructure that's being supported by outside entities from those regions. You see a lot of destabilizing communication coming from other parts of the world. And then people who are a little less educated, a little more ignorant, don't have access to good information, fall prey to these bad ideas, and then those bad ideas spread like a virus. Matt Tyler, the UK has seen a lot of 5G towers burned down, and I mean a lot. Arthur Lee 525, how does one correlate the situation in 5G? Without getting too into it, and please don't support these topics. I mean, like, as a personal responsibility, I don't want to regurgitate all of the information that I found, lest someone start searching for YouTube and Facebook content and help popularize this this content. But the one that I had to mute a couple people for on Twitter, I unfollowed and I muted a bunch of people on Twitter, were sending out these infographics that looked really official, that were linking the construction of 5G towers to the spread of the situation, and then claiming that it was because of these new radio technologies that what we were really seeing was radiation poisoning. And on its surface, if you are naturally an individual who does not follow the scientific method, who is ignorant as to how science and technology works, and you're susceptible to this type of manipulated groupthink, it is a very effective stapling together of two completely unrelated ideas. Oh, look, these population centers have seen an explosion in cases of the situation. And wouldn't you know it, these are also the main test markets for 5G. Again, it's a correlation that has no linking or causation other than population density, which both are affected by. And then they need to come up with a reason. Well, wouldn't you know it, some of the symptoms of radiation poisoning look a lot like what we're dealing with today. And boom, you've got a conspiracy theory. People feel like they're the truth seekers. People feel like they're taking it to the man and fighting that kind of stuff. And then, you can kind of spread it that way. You got a foreign interest involved in an information spread like that. And it can be very effective in destabilizing the telecommunications infrastructure of a country. You've just convinced all of these susceptible people to go and damage 5G towers. Well, now the people in that region have less effective communications equipment. So I didn't actually mean to completely revisit this one right here. Arthur Lee 525, the energy in 5G is thousands of times weaker than any energy that could cause radiation poisoning. It's not even powerful enough to cause ionization in molecules. Of course, if you're rational and you've done any research on this, yeah, that's the problem, is the people who research these kinds of topics by going through YouTube videos likely aren't doing any of that kind of research. Or, again, they always kind of link these ideas in the most casual way, but they get the sick visceral thrill of being the outsider or being the skeptic. And once that person is latched on emotionally to that idea, I don't know that there's a way to correct for that. Same thing with flat earthers. Evidence doesn't matter. In fact, the more evidence you give them, the more they're going to dig their heels in. So when more of these topics come up, I feel it's, again, as a tech community, and the fact that we need to pay attention to politics. Ignoring politics is a luxury we cannot afford. When more of these topics come up, it's critical that we examine how this stuff gets spread. And the most disappointing one was over the last couple days, was seeing the incredible number of protests, staged protests here in the United States, trying to defy the stay-at-home and social distancing orders of various communities. We're not on proper lockdown here in California, in the greater LA area. But, you know, my wife and I, we're holding to stay at home. It's driving us crazy. We're going stir crazy. I feel terrible for my daughter. She's a very social and active and outgoing kid. It's not worth the risk for our household. So we're trying to lead by example. We're trying to minimize as much outside exposure as we can possibly cope with. So to see groups of people gathering to protest these stay-at-home orders is especially disappointing, as we're reaching that peak, as we're starting to finally realize the benefits of flattening the curve. And we could potentially, again, it might take months, but we could potentially be on the downswing where we can really walk back from this stuff. Now we've got a groups of ignorant and angry people potentially making the situation far, far worse. A couple people on Reddit this is not deep dive and this is not forensic. So again, I'm putting this with a huge rock of salt, but it's concerning. A group of people on Reddit have been looking into some of the information from these websites that are popping up for these staged protests. Let me go back to the original tweet came from Colin McMillan. Somebody did some extremely basic Who is searching and found that the person who set up all of the reopen state name protest websites is in fact one guy in Jacksonville. So when we start seeing all of these ridiculous protests popping up, it's astroturfed and coordinated from one guy who set up a majority of these protest websites. And then that idea spreads and then it builds and it starts gathering its own following that way. So let's defy state orders. This is from the actual Reddit. There's an imperial ton of astroturfing going on. It's quite visible in how those groups popped up literally overnight. The thing is that they targeted groups who were more receptive to the idea and who wouldn't be inclined to look any deeper into what they were joining. And they've got like the Who Is data, you know, the website data from all of these GoDaddy domains, all coming from the same place. We all know those people who spread bad information on Facebook. We all have those family members who casually kind of skim an article headline and get, you know, outraged by something that wasn't really true or accurate. And we all know those people that are very easily fall prey to this kind of bad information. When things like this pop up, it is on us to be good tech neighbors, to be good tech citizens, to try and help walk people back from the edge. I know it is the most infuriating aspect of dealing with family and with friends. You know, we all have some of those friends who should be smarter than this, but sometimes prove that they aren't. Right now, I don't believe it is in our best interest to just walk away and let them think bad information. I know sometimes it's not worth the fight. I know sometimes it's not worth the struggle, but they got to this point through irrational, emotional outrage content. It's worth our time and it's worth our frustration. It's worth our smashing our faces against brick walls to point out, oh, by the way, that was fake. By the way, one dude in Jacksonville is totally playing you. And it becomes its own little like counter flavor of conspiracy, right? So if they got a sick thrill out of a conspiracy theory linking bad ideas together, or they got a sick thrill out of being contrarian to the government, you know, trying to keep us down, there's also a sick thrill involved in like, oh, by the way, none of this is real. All of this is fake. So hopefully by continuing to have these conversations, we can be the resources for our family and friends to spread better information out there. oh man, we're getting some other conversation on, from Matt Tyler. All it takes is one stupid person and a bit of momentum and you have a problem. From Mimranglot, they should be seeing what countries who actually stayed at home did, and results of the stay at home. Malaysia recorded like less than 40 news cases today. And I mean, like a number of other countries that have been weathering the storm better. We have a lot to learn from them, especially in a country as broad and as diverse as the United States, where each state is kind of a mini country unto itself. California by itself is the world's fifth largest economy. It's been disappointing. It's been disappointing to see how easily some of this narrative can be manipulated by bad actors, by people with, you know, sort of dark or nefarious goals. From Heike, I read on a newspaper that there were even protests by armed men in the USA. Unfortunately, a number of our protests in the USA just have a contingent where people show up with assault rifles because that's their right. At this point, unless there's something tragic that happens at one of those events, it's not even worth getting that upset about, as people like to posture. The United States, we like to posture a lot. You know, there are a lot of chest puffery moments from the United States these days that I don't feel like we've really earned it, or we can really back up the posturing, which is, again, unfortunate that we're not having more reasonable grown-up conversations about this situation and other situations too. So, again, when I find something like this, I kind of want to add it to the pile of topics that we've been talking about, because I feel like this is also going to be one of the most critical aspects of communication in the 21st century. We have a huge psychological problem on our hands, and I don't know what the first steps are to solving it, but I know it's not staying silent and just going, oh, well, whatever, dumb people gonna dumb. Unfortunately, I feel like we need to take action. I just don't know what that action is. Moving right along, let's kind of shift gears a bit into some tech. I've got two stories here. One is something very hopeful. It's something I've been dying for. It is a topic that I really would hope would happen. And then the other one is one more follow up on a scary security story that we had from a while back. So let me copy this out here. Axios has a scoop, but it's something that we've been casually floating around the idea for a while. I just dropped the link in the live chat, and this is the screen share. Is my screen off? Yeah, my screen is like way off. Hold on, let me adjust my my screen share here. From Ina Fried, from Axios.com, Scoop, Google readies its own chip for future Pixels and Chromebooks. And from the article, Google has made significant progress towards developing its own processor to power future versions of its Pixel smartphone as soon as next year, and eventually Chromebooks as well. Why it matters: the move could help Google better compete with Apple, which designs its own chips. It would be a blow to Qualcomm, which supplies processors for many current high-end phones, including the Pixel. The chip, codenamed Whitechapel, was designed in cooperation with Samsung, whose state-of-the-art 5-nanometer technology would be used to manufacture the chips, according to a source familiar with Google's efforts. Samsung has also manufactured Apple's iPhone chips as well as its own Exynos processors. So, get this out of the way here. This could be epic. I am anxiously and tentatively very excited for a future collaboration between Google and Samsung on chip fabrication. The Pixel 4 did not get enough credit for the co-processors on that phone, especially when it came to image processing. The Pixel 4 is able to outperform Snapdragon 865s in really heavy lifting situations like 4K video rendering because of Google's custom coprocessors, the custom hardware in a Pixel 4. Its ability to chew up visual information is still second to none. So you can go and you can look at synthetic benchmarks, and, oh, the Pixel 4 just doesn't perform as well as the Galaxy S10, brr, 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 brr. You put images onto a phone and you edit them or you cut them or you render them in any way, and the Pixel 4 is going to completely murk any other device out there. I mean, you put a Pixel 4 up against an iPhone 11 Pro, and it's obscene how much faster, how much more powerful the Pixel 4 is than the iPhone 11 Pro. And again, we're talking about pro heavy lifting, not, oh, can I open Twitters faster? I'm talking about cutting up 4K video, mashing together different timelines and clips and audio, and really trying to do something on your phone. At the same time, part of the problem that we have with smartphones in this market today is because of the two-year plan that Qualcomm has had for the 5G launch. Everything that we're playing with today has been in the pipeline for around 2 years, give or take. Well, 2 years ago, we weren't concerned about a global pandemic wrecking the economy of most of the nations on this planet and putting consumers into the most vulnerable position for buying consumer electronics that we've ever seen in my lifetime. So the 5G launch from Qualcomm was predicated on Qualcomm's practical monopoly of 5G technology and the fact that there is almost no competition for things like low-power ARM processors. Samsung's Exynos, fallen behind. Apple, they only make kit for their own devices. You've got the Kirin, you've got MediaTek. None of that makes any type of major play in first world countries developing markets like North America and Canada and the United States. They just don't exist here. So you look at the Pixel 4, component pricing was already expensive for the Snapdragon 855. It's even more expensive for all of the component pricing and licensing to properly support phones in the United States. 5G is going to be a mess of carrier lock-in, so you've got to pay out the nose to support the United States with a 5G phone, especially if it's going to be on more than one carrier. We're totally going to see this in the Pixel 5. That is, I don't think that's any bold prediction. We're going to see so many more manufacturers pivot to the 700 series, the mid-range series chipsets. They're a little less expensive. You can still staple on a 5G radio. They're going to perform just fine for the majority of heavy smartphone users out there. This is the reality of when we tie everything to a monopolistic market like ARM processors and Qualcomm. If Google and Samsung can make a sidestep, the Pixel becomes a significantly more desirable product. Google in-house chip design directly supporting the types of software features that Google would want, putting those ISPs, those image processors, into the main chipset as opposed to having them be co-processors of a Qualcomm chipset. Just imagine the Pixel photo processing capabilities of a device that was built from the ground up to support that type of AI manipulation of content. Everything gets a bit more exciting for the Pixel if Google can pull off their own custom silicon. So I will be watching this with rapt attention. I am ridiculously excited to see what even a Gen 1, a first generation collaboration between Google design and Samsung manufacturing could produce. And something tells me if Google is the one responsible for fabricating, doing the actual design of the fabrication, that they will probably be able to play with that component pricing in a way that makes this a bit more disruptive against like a mid-tier Qualcomm. You know, when you have to go out and buy chips from Qualcomm, something tells me like that shows up on a rate sheet in a slightly different way than if Google's like, well, we've got the costs for this and we've kind of absorbed the costs for that and we can kind of offset some of these costs. I'm not saying it's going to be like the Nexus where, you know, I don't think Google made any money on Nexus devices. They were probably sold at a loss because they were developer hardware. But it would be interesting to see if Google could make an upper mid-range chipset in terms of just outright power, but then the software hardware optimization took that performance up to flagship level. Something tells me that device would probably end up being less expensive for Google to sell than always playing ball with Qualcomm's component pricing. And Mim Ranglot. And remember, guys, Samsung is working with AMD for RDNA and future Exynos. So, I mean, imagine, like, you know, a desktop-grade graphics support for smartphones. From Vic Erz, I'm concerned about Samsung manufacturing. I'm disappointed with my S10 battery life with the Exynos. So there's a difference there. Samsung has their own in-house chip design team, which a couple weeks back, I don't know, it was actually now probably a couple months back, we talked about how Samsung was actually going to be getting rid of a good chunk of that team, and they were going to be doing less aggressive custom designing for the Exynos chipset. Future versions of Exynos are probably going to be a bit more ARM spec than they were custom hardware designed by Samsung. Samsung is just going to be doing the fabrication. They're just going to be doing the manufacturing of the chipset. Google will be designing the chipset. Because again, Samsung already does this for the iPhone. No one talks about the A13 and the upcoming A14 as TSMC or TSMC? I can never remember what the letters are for that company. But there were two major companies that were doing the fabrication, the actual, like, we make the chip, but we didn't design the chip building. TSMC. Thank you, Imrang Lot. So there wasn't much of a performance disparity between chips that were made by Samsung and chips that were made by TSMC. I know people would get down in there and like, oh, there's a 2% delta on this type of graphics benchmark. That wasn't nearly as wide a performance hit as what we see between Exynos and the Snapdragon. So again, that's why I'm more positive on this. It's not Google is going to reach out to Samsung for the Exynos and they're going to start putting the Exynos into Pixels. It's Google is designing a chip and Samsung's going to do the fabrication on it. That makes me more positive on this. And Memrenglot also, TSMC makes the cores for AMD. So chiplet design, that TSMC is doing real well on that. All right. One last story. This one I'm not going to spend a lot of time on, but I really want you folks out there to read this story. Months back, and I can't remember when. I need to actually start going, like, listing the topics. Like, just keep a spreadsheet for what I talk about in every episode of the podcast. Months back, we talked about a really scary malware that was hitting Android. It's called X Helper. Certain types of certain phones and certain versions of Android were particularly vulnerable to this exploit, which creates a backdoor and is unremovable. Security experts could not find, when we first talked about the story, security experts could not find a way to remove it. You'd wipe the phone and it would come right back and it would just start pre-installing a bunch of malware on these phones. It was a really freaky Android exploit, which again was, at the time, it was for me more evidence that we need better software and security patching for older Android devices out there. So Ars Technica has a follow-up on this story that went live about a week ago. The secret behind unkillable Android backdoor called X Helper has been revealed. The precise cause of the reinfections stumped researchers for months. And Dan Gooden over in Ars Technica is doing phenomenal work on tracking this type of these types of security exploits. If you're not reading Ars Technica, you totally should be. And just from the from the article, the analysis found that the unusual persistence was the result of rogue folders containing a Trojan installer, neither of which was removed by a reset. The Trojan dropper would then reinstall the backdoor in the event of a reset. Despite those insights, the researchers still didn't know precisely how that happened. Now, a different researcher has filled in the missing pieces. More about that later, but first a brief summary of X Helper. This was freaky. The ability for a piece of malware to get super user rights and build a backdoor, real freaky. So read through this article, at least be aware there. We're starting to see that there could be some way of attacking the exploit and restoring some of, you know, the protections to people who have out-of-date security patches. I'm sure newer versions of Android will probably be more resilient against this, but we also know that the vast majority of Android devices out there are now starting to sunset. Most of the people still currently using Android devices are on builds of Android that are kind of end-of-lifing for security updates and probably never got any security updates from the manufacturers. Oh, whoops. I shared the old, oh, dang it. Hold on. Give me 1 second. There we go. So I accidentally hit paste in my browser bar and then shared the wrong link. Here, I'm sharing the right link here from Ars Technica. But again, the name of the article, The Secret Behind Unkillable Android Backdoor Called X Helper, has been revealed on Ars Technica. So let's take a quick break here, and let's plug the subreddit. Every podcast has a subreddit. I have a subreddit. Some subreddits are built on sharing news clips. You know, these are topics we want you to talk about. Some subreddits are just cool fan hangout places, and some subreddits are just set up to tell the podcast hosts how awesome they are. My subreddit is none of those things. I've taken sort of the personal interest of spreading good information and celebrating content creators and trying to help build audiences. And my project is a subreddit built on trying to help content creators get more attention. The whole subreddit is built on the idea of, if you feel someone deserves more viewership, or you think someone's making cool content and they're not getting the love, hopefully you are participating on reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. And every week we pick up a few more subscribers. Every week we see a few more posts. We're seeing more upvotes. We're seeing more comments. There's a bit more discussion that's happening. We need your active participation. We need your upvotes to help promote better content. And every time I go to the subreddit, I'm always so happy and so excited to see a variety of topics from an international community of content producers. If you go to YouTube, you're going to see sort of just that trending list. And YouTube, even with your own subscriptions, just like Facebook, they're going to manipulate your subscription list to try and keep you engaged on the most tentpole popular content. And if you're like me, that means when a new phone comes out, your YouTube is just murked, is just obliterated by the exact same videos on the exact same phone from the exact same people over and over and over again. The community over at Glowing Rectangles has, again, weekly, consistently, impresses me with the variety of topics that they're interested in. And this is mostly tech and geek focused, but you know, occasionally something sneaks through, like a really good cooking video. But just every time I go there, I find someone new that I wasn't watching from before, and they become another YouTube channel that I have to subscribe to. So reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. And I like to go through the top stories. I had a pretty good week last week, just in general. It's not common that my videos are the top videos on Glowing Rectangles, or my articles are the top articles on Glowing Rectangles. My subreddit is not about me, but I had a strong week last week, so I got some upvotes, I got some love, and the A number one story on Glowing Rectangles was my dual screen power user video for the LG V60. I'm ridiculously proud of that one. You know, again, I make the joke about, oh, some dude with a doofy hat and a punchable face just made it to the top of the subreddit. But I had a lot of fun on that video. And I put out a couple videos recently that were very experimental. I tried my PowerDirector video. I did a tour of PowerDirector video editing in PowerDirector. Like, you actually see the screen grab of me talking about PowerDirector in PowerDirector. That video was freaking hard to make, and it got like 1,000 views. So I'm doing the thumbs up. I'm having a little proud of me moment. The V60 video, amped, super legit, hyped up power user dude. I need to have a good name. I think I'm going to call him Power User. A good name for that character. But number one, I did it, guys. I did it. But I want to go through some of the other top stories here. Oh, I didn't upload it. Let me upload this now. Matt Tyler shared a Mr. Mobile video checking out the Moto G stylus, also rounding out the top stories on our glowing rectangles. My sister from another Mr., Trisha Hirschberger, has the companion video to my homeschooling tech from Newegg. So she's got a video talking about Chromebooks and how we can use Chromebooks for education and homeschooling. My bro, my homie, my buddy, LFA Reviews, also rounding out the top 10 with the M-Pow Flame Pro versus Soundpeat's True Wings True Wireless Earbuds. So some really solid-looking True Wireless headphones, especially for those of you that are working out and you need those ear hooks, but maybe you didn't want to fork over all that cash for some Beats. TK Bay. Doing his live stream. Oh, that's another one too. TK Bay has brought back Saturday mornings with the Side of Tech, and this last Saturday he had Josh Vergara on the show. Great show. Again, if you're into this long form gadget podcasty kind of conversation on technology, get back on TK's channel. We really need to give him some love because his podcast was doing really well, and then YouTube kind of savaged it and he stopped doing it. So he's trying to bring it back. If you're an audience of my kind of content, there's no reason why you shouldn't also be giving TK some love too, especially when he's got guests on, because I don't have guests as often as he does. And him and Josh chatting about this kind of stuff is just, it's just so much fun. Like, you feel like you're just kind of sitting around a coffee table, hanging out with some cool guys, talking about our favorite phones. They're so good at having that kind of a conversation.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Hey, what's going on, Juan, and all of you tuned in to today's show. I'm Nick Gray from Fandroid. I've known Juan for quite a few years now, and you may have actually heard my voice from back in the day when Juan used to host the Pocket Now Weekly. If you're not familiar with Fandroid, we were actually the very first Android news site to hit the web, publishing our very first article within hours of Google making their announcement about their mobile operating system. Of course, a lot has changed since then, but we're still here covering the news, reviewing new gadgets, and of course, sharing our passion for Android with anyone who wants to join in. You can find all of our work on Fandroid.com. That's Phandroid.com. But if you love video, and I'm sure you do since you're listening to Juan's podcast, be sure to check us out at youtube.com/Fandroid as well. And that's going to do it. Juan, thanks for featuring us. Back to you.
Let's see. We've got Nothing But Tech 88. Just a quick catch-up video on some big news coming from her channel. Again, another exciting up-and-coming YouTuber. One of my favorites. I cannot tell you how much I love the Gadget Byte channel. Their style, their vibe is so chill. I love their content. And they've got a review on the Samsung Galaxy M21. And they built in a comparison against the Realme 6. So those are phones that I don't have access to. Those are devices that we don't get here in the United States. And I would probably never read up on or review, or personally go hands-on with. So Gadget Byte has been a phenomenal resource as a North American content creator just to get a better lay of the land with all of the other brands that don't do business here in the United States. So some absolutely phenomenal content. This week was so strong for diversity of audio tech, smartphones, cameras, tips and tricks videos, tutorials. Dean Nimmin had a pretty high-ranking video talking about StreamYard's dark mode. Someone shared the Sony handheld PC review from 2006. Alex Gassaway. Hold on, I also want to show Alex. She is making camera and creator tech videos. And so she has a video up, how I faked the Lawowa probe lens look. So there are these, super crazy macro probe lenses that you can put on cameras. And she was able to kind of recreate the look of that probe macro. If you're interested in some of the nuts and bolts of photography and deeper dive on content creation, her channel is shaping up to be a terrific resource for that kind of content as well. Those videos, nowhere to be seen on my actual subscriptions list on YouTube. I told YouTube, this is the kind of content I'm interested in. And when a new creator pops up on Glowing Rectangles, I subscribe to them on YouTube. They are not often showcased in my feed. So again, I'm putting that call to action, that call to the community. If you want to broaden the conversation, if you want to find new voices in technology, in content, in geekery, help us share, help us promote, help us upvote this content, help us make it more search viable. Every week, this stuff gets a little bit bigger and a little bit easier to find. And if this can be a good feeder subreddit, we're going to start seeing people cross-posting and sharing on other larger subreddits. And someone like Alex Gassaway getting shared over on like an R Cameras would be a huge boon for her channel. And if you found her through R Glowing Rectangles, then you can double whammy. You can help promote someone who deserves more attention because she's doing great work. So, folks, I really, again, I just can't say enough nice things about the little subreddit that I helped create. And especially, it's not normally a subreddit about me, even though I took the top spot. I won my subreddit this week. Woot, 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 woot. Rubberneck, 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 rubberneck. It's me. I win. I'm the winner. Matt Tyler, the little subreddit that could. And Def Burns, now subscribing. Do it. Do it. You should have been all over this subreddit. I love it. Let me get this out of the way here. Come on. Punch Con. Yeah, you're completely humble about it. Like, no, I'm not. It's my subreddit. And I'm not regularly the top video on my own subreddit. So again, when I win, I feel like I've really earned something. Reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Please check it out. We need your help. We need your love. We need your support. And again, you can self-promote. We're not like those other larger subreddits where if you post your own stuff that we're going to freak out and censor you from the subreddit. But really, it's all about content creators out there who deserve more attention and deserve more love for what they do. That's the vibe. It's all about love. So let's help spread the love. Matt Tyler, recently you were at the top. It's fixed. Last week, I was nowhere to be seen in my own top five. I don't even want to hear it. And Def Burns, you have to fight against all of us that actively downvote you. I mean, I'm getting flashbacks from having my articles removed from our Android. Someone told me that they tried to share, I think it was, they tried to share my V60 review. And that it was removed for self-promotion. And then someone else said, hey, I tried to share a link to your podcast, and it was removed for self-promotion. And again, like, no one was promoting their own stuff, but apparently our Android hates me. So it's just a Verge and MKBHD love fest over on our Android. Matt Tyler, just downvote him so he's not in the top five. I did that earlier to try to bump them up in the top two. You guys suck. I love it. And everyone say hey to Kapakosh. This is their first time in the live chat. So everyone send him a thumbs up. Memranglot, love chat works too. It's great. Okay. Sorry. I'm trying not to just like burp directly into my camera here, but my voice is kind of failing on me. So I'm trying to drink as much water as I can. We're into the gadget block. I've got two quick little pickup stories because again, they're topics that keep coming up. So we should keep following them. I love Huawei cameras. Ever since the Huawei P9, there is something so unique. There's something so different. Their focus on photography has been such a boon to the Android community. I unfortunately have not been able to spend much hands-on time with any Huawei since the Mate 20. So I missed out on the 30 series last year, and I've been reaching out and trying to go, you know, like maybe even just get loaners from other friends. But I'm probably not going to have time to go deep dive on the P40. And it's really disappointing because I feel like Huawei has such an interesting conversation to be had about separating yourself from a conglomerate like Google. You know, like if anyone could stage a public competition fight, Huawei has a great talking point that instead they're letting the tech community treat it like it's an instant deal breaker. No Google services, you're out of here. And I feel like there are enough people around the world who would be interested in a conversation about not putting all of their data eggs into Google's basket. It's not the majority of smartphone users. It's not even myself personally. But I feel like there's a security or a contrarian conversation to be had. So it always makes me especially cranky when Huawei gets caught playing some shenanigans. And this is not the first time they've been caught with a situation like this. Coming out of Android Authority, written up by Adamya Sharma, Huawei caught... Oh, let me get the link in the live chat. Huawei caught claiming DSLR images were taken with its phones. Huawei is once again in the spotlight for passing off DSLR images as taken with Huawei smartphones. The company recently promoted a photography contest on Chinese microblogging platform Weibo, posting a video with a number of stunning photographs. It claimed these pictures were shot by Huawei phones. However, one of those images was taken using a $3,000 Nikon D850. And they actually have the image that Huawei included in that video. It's... I want to say in recent memory that this is the third time I have seen this, almost this exact same headline talking about Huawei phones and Huawei cameras. And it's the third time Huawei has not needed to do this, that Huawei cameras represent such a unique and powerful option in the Android, and I should say just in the smartphone, global smartphone ecosystem, that this is especially tragic. There was no need for them to include other cameras, other content in a video hyping up their own phone. They should be especially concerned about the perception of their brand right now. And they claimed that this was a mistake. The photo was wrongly marked. It was not supposed to be included. But why was this content in anywhere near their bucket of promo photos from the P40? That is a mistake you cannot make when you're a brand like Huawei right now, and especially when the camera is one of the top marketing points of your phone opposite all of the Android competition, and you're trying to get away from this issue with Google services and, you know, the security and the global economy and the Huawei brand, blah, 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 blah. You can't make a stumble like this. It's so frustrating because you just want... For those of you who are competition junkies like me, where I just want as many options in the smartphone ecosystem as I can possibly have, including options on operating systems where I could be interested in a Huawei OS, that could be interesting to me, makes me frustrated when they make dumb mistakes like this. Gabaletta, I know there's a saying that any PR is good PR if it gets them in the headlines. Not so much. And Matt Tyler went, was it, you did the P30, Matt? So please remind me. These cameras are among my favorite to use, so why lie? I don't get it. Kyle Ruggles, it's not a mistake. Mim Ranglot, the monochrome sensors in the P20 and Mate 20 were the best ever. Q3 Becker, LG's marketing, silence. Huawei's marketing, hold my beer. So just a bummer. This doesn't take anything away from the actual cameras on Huawei devices. It's just the perception that matters. The attention that we're giving to these companies. It's just a bummer. Moving right along, I'm bringing this story up because last week I was called a Samsung hater LG shill because I brought up some software issues that were facing the, was it the Galaxy Note 9? I want to say was the phone last week. It was either the Note 9 or the Note 10. But something was going on with a batch of Samsung phones and a recent Samsung update that was causing some severe burn-in issues on older Samsung devices. It would seem that was not localized to just one generation of Samsung phones. And again, this is the absolute worst time to have an issue which could potentially damage a product. If you own a Samsung device, this would be the absolute worst time to install an update which could potentially damage your screen. And so I've got a pair of stories here from my old haunt, pocketnow.com. Let me go back to the first one first. Lee Kelly, Samsung is at work to fix the green tint issue on the Galaxy S20's display. And then a very quick follow-up from Samuel Martinez. They've just decided to pull the update, which causes the screen issues on the Galaxy S20 Ultra. So if we go back to the first article here, there was a recent update that hit the Galaxy S20s. It's not affecting everyone, but there is sort of a combination of screen and power management settings that cause this really ugly green tint to hit your display. This seems to me like this could exacerbate some of the burn-in issues that OLEDs traditionally fall prey to. So a recent, I believe it was the March update that Note 9 owners were pinning on their screen problems. And we're in kind of the same window of updates for the Galaxy S20. Something Samsung is doing for their power management and screen management software seems to be affecting small production batches of Note 9s, S9s, and S20s. I'm not saying, you know, Samsung can't do anything right, and no one should ever buy a Samsung. What I'm saying is, chances are pretty good that if you don't own a Galaxy, you know people who do. And this would be the right time to give them the heads up to say, by the way, if you just recently updated your phone, check out these display settings, and you should be safe. That's it. Again, if we're going to be good tech neighbors and good tech citizens, we don't just grade Samsung on a curve and say, well, they'll fix it eventually. Having a screen burn-in issue because of a Samsung software update kind of wrecks the experience of owning a Samsung phone. So we spread the word on these types of stories and these types of situations, not to say you shouldn't buy a Samsung, but to say, be aware so that it doesn't mess you up. I don't know anyone out there who's just going to, you know, be fine with their $1,000 Samsung phone screen getting burnt to a crisp because of an update when they could have been told, oh, just make sure you turn down the refresh rate. Samsung's going to have a patch out in a couple weeks. You're going to be fine. That's the reasonable communication to have with a consumer base. From Meme Ringlet, there are always lemons. This to me, now we've got 2 weeks of stories on multiple devices, not just like one person showing off a problem with the screen. We're seeing numerous Samsung forum posts from people affected on the Note 9, the S9, and the Galaxy S20. This is a decently widespread issue. It doesn't seem to be every phone affected, which means to me the minute differences in batches of screens something is hitting the power management features of Samsung displays, and it seems to be affecting small groups of those display manufacturing batches. But that also makes owning a phone from one manufacturer something like a lottery. Every phone is going to have some kind of issue, right? A one-off device might have a battery failure, might have some other type of problem. This is now being demonstrated and replicated across a pretty broad collection of different phones. So it's worth pointing out. It's worth talking about to hopefully save someone some grief with their super premium phone purchase. Let me take another sip of water here. From Rue Sunshine, burn-ins on the best screen in the market? Someone else gave me some grief on my V60 review. The comment was something along the lines of, oh, look how fast you flipped your story on IPS displays. And like, I think you're talking about how I said the LG G7 had a really good screen. That was over 2.5 years ago. I feel like the realities of smartphone ownership, like if there were more companies making great LCD displays, I'd still be saying I like LCD tech, but I have no options to talk about LCD tech. I think we're all kind of looking at what sort of the next generation of micro dot or micro LED or whatever new tech comes after OLED. But for as much as I think OLED looks cool, it's that consumer, juicy, vibrant, high contrast display technology that we've all come to say is the de facto standard for a phone. OLEDs burn in easier. That's the gig. So, it just goes with owning an OLED. And from Android GR. Well, the G7 screen was good. It was. You can't please everybody on YouTube. And some days it kind of feels like you can't please anyone on YouTube. All right, out of some bad news. We talked about it a lot, but LG put out a teaser. I want to show this teaser. It'll probably get my video demonetized on YouTube, but what the heck. The new Velvet coming out. I think this is going to be LG's pivot to the premium mid-range. Probably a shot at where OnePlus used to position or price their gadgets. And I just want to show it here so that we can talk about it a little bit more. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Why isn't it the screen sharing? Oh, there we go. Okay, cool. I fixed it. And so this is the actual Korean LG Velvet design video. I'm going to make sure I'm not playing any music. And let's see. There's a water drop, and that creates a camera. Then we see cameras kind of drop off of that. And then we see the full phone, and it's got rounded edges and curves. It does look kind of like the love child of a Lumia and an Xperia. It's very rectangular, and it's tall, and it's skinny, and it's slim, and it's sleek. Some cool shadow effects. It looks like they're going to have kind of a pearlescent quality to the back glass. Ooh, look at that wraparound. Ooh, and if you notice in the bottom there, it's got a headphone jack. So the LG is going to be sticking with headphone jacks, and life is good. Boom, video's out. I still don't love curved glass for display. I hope that the curvature to the front screen is not so severe that it makes this a fragile bar of soap, kind of slippery glass design. But I like the look. I think it looks good. I think this is actually a really critical transition moment for LG. The V series has always been their workhorse. That's their diesel truck of a phone. I mean, just look back at phones like the V20. There was nothing sexy about the V20. There was nothing stylish about the V20. That phone was just a monster truck of capability in the rejected lines of a BlackBerry profile. But I adored what that phone could do. I think there is a critical value right now for LG dividing their pro phone line. This V series... No one is calling this the sexiest looking phone of 2020, right? But there is some value for a manufacturer to have a pretty phone that looks cool on store shelves. It was always the dividing line between the P series and the Mate series for Huawei. But the G series for LG basically just morphed into the V series. Especially by the time we got to the G8X, there were almost no differences between the different permutations of G and V. So I think this is important to carve out, to carve out a new consumer price point and a new consumer-focused device for LG to have a differentiator, to have a different model on the market. Hold on, I have to look up a tweet real quick. Oh no, this wasn't a tweet. Hold on, I've got to open this. I've got to share this. I'm so mad I did not think of this joke first, and I have to properly credit the person who actually did front the joke. Give me 1 second. This is terrible podcasting here. Everyone make fun of me. I need to show you just how like dim I was on one of the best dad jokes of the year. So LG's calling this the Velvet, and Elijah comments on one of my LG videos, and this is the exchange that we had. Elijah, if LG don't make a red LG Velvet phone, I'm going to be upset. And I replied just straight, like, ditto, the red G8 was gorgeous, because it was. Elijah Plummer, not to mention the fun food pun if you get a red one. I just like had to facepalm really hard. LG, please. Again, I don't know that I'll be able to get a review unit. I don't know if I'll be able to go hands-on. If I go hands-on, I need an LG Red Velvet. Oh, God, I need that so bad now. But Elijah Plummer totally beat me to the best dad joke pun of the Velvet lineup. And I had to share that. That cracked me up hard. All right. we're getting to around 10:30 here. And I feel like the most important part of the gadget block... I need to switch mugs. So we're retiring the green megapickle mug. We're going to the black megapickle mug as I drink more water. So of the last week, probably the most important tech or smartphone, I should say, the most important smartphone story of the week, Apple. Apple finally took the wraps off of the new iPhone SE. Oh, did I not get my other SE's over on the bookcase? I'm going to leave it over there. I don't need a prop for this segment. I'm going to screen share here in just a bit. I am ridiculously excited for an iPhone SE 2020. I feel like the iPhone 5 to date remains the absolute best combination of hardware software synergy. iOS was built around the most ergonomic one thumb navigation, offered the most streamlined daily use, and I still think it's the prettiest design. When we look at the new iPads and these rumors for the iPhone 12, a lot of those rumors are getting us back to the design language of the iPhone 5. The iPhone 5 with its flush rear camera, its aluminum body, glass panels for radios and antennas. And I'm sorry, especially in an age of situation face masks, Face ID is still not nearly as convenient when you're out and about as Touch ID. And it's even worse now when most of your face is obscured and I'm wearing sunglasses and a mask. I cannot use my iPhones out in public. I need fingerprint sensors. When I brought my Apple Watch back out of retirement, it's paired with my iPhone SE. And my iPhone SE, pull it out of the pocket, it's unlocked before I'm even looking at it. One thumb, minimal contact. I do the message, I respond to the query, I put it back in my pocket, and I'm back on with my day. To get an iPhone 8 clone with modern iPhone guts is such a boon to the iOS community. Now, I haven't reviewed it. I don't have it in-house. Chatty Boy over on Periscope saying he's probably going to, you know, Chatty Boy saying the iPhone SE is going to be the best-selling phone of 2020. I don't find any fault with that. At $399 in the United States, I don't know about the best-selling phone in the world, but the best-selling individual phone, the one phone that I think is going to sell the best, I think is going to be the iPhone SE 2020. We're back to Touch ID. We've got the same processor. You know, while I'm doing this, let me go into the screen share from the Apple website, and I'm just going to drop into these tech specs right here. It's pants on head silly that the starting storage is still 64 gig, but it's Apple, and that's how they convince you to spend more money. So we're looking at this. No notch design, so we no longer have a unibrow cutting into the content of videos and games. It's still the iPhone 8 form factor. I'm hoping that iPhone 8 cases are going to be compatible, like my iPhone SE cases were compatible. My iPhone 5 cases were compatible with the iPhone SE. We got the A13 chip, which is a baller powerful processor. The battery is probably going to take a hit because let me scroll down. This is hilarious because Apple is terrible at this. So, you know, we're looking at the spec sheet for the iPhone SE 2020. So power and battery, do they tell us what the battery capacity is? Oh, no. They just say, oh, well, it lasts about the same as the iPhone 8. That's their battery spec. I need that to sink in. Apple didn't tell us the capacity. And they're giving us rough, like, oh, you can play video for 13 hours. How big is the battery? How long does the battery last? What is the capacity? It's about the same as the iPhone 8. Tell me any other manufacturer who could get away with that kind of nonsense. That's nonsense. That is PR marketing nonsense. I am so excited for the iPhone SE 2020. That's BS. How big is the battery? Oh, it's gonna be bigger, but I don't know. Pants on head dumb. Okay, sorry, I'm better now. I'm sorry, like just getting real frustrated by that. But basically, the return here, the philosophy here for the iPhone SE is to take the form factor of their retired phone and to include more modern internals. So we've got the A13. We've got, I believe this is the same camera sensor that was in the iPhone XR. Someone please correct me if I'm wrong there. Video 4K recording up to 60 frames per second, but the 4K video on the iPhone SE will not feature the extended dynamic range. It's not quite true HDR on an iPhone 11 Pro, but it is like enhanced shadow detail and brings in more information from highlights. It's why the iPhone 11 Pro has very pretty video. So it seems like the iPhone SE is not going to be able to do that at 60 frames per second, but it will be able to do that at 30 frames per second. 7 megapixels selfie camera. I can't tell you. I cannot tell you how excited I am to see Touch ID return. But again, we have those other Apple compromises. We know that the radio management and the antennas are not going to be as good as they are on decently competitive upper mid-range Android solutions. I'm trying to find, let me go back down to here. But one of the other things that's going to be not only just for iOS users, but for the industry in general. And someone, again, please correct me if I'm wrong. I believe this is the least expensive smartphone at retail pricing that will include wireless charging. I'm really trying to remember if we've seen any other Android phone under $399 that included Qi charging, wireless charging on it. So, those all add up to a really formidable mid-ranger phone. This completely fulfills what I loved about the original iPhone SE. Apple now has proper current purpose-built phones for three different price tiers. This is not recycling an older phone to fulfill a lower price point. The transition from the iPhone 7 into the iPhone 10 was a really rough transition, and it left Apple in a very strange state with keeping the iPhone 8 on as an older device so that they would have cheaper carrier deals, you know, something you could walk into an MVNO, like a Boost Mobile, and pick up a cheap iPhone. Now, you can only do that for so long. The iPhone 5 showed us there was a market for a smaller form factor device. People were still buying the 5 and the 5S internationally. It was still a really popular form factor, but the chipset and the hardware were getting so old that it starts to impact your ability to push out software updates. You know, the entire iOS community all seems held back by the lowest common denominator device. So the new software and the new features that you get on your iPhone 11 Pro, that's influenced by, iOS is influenced by, can it run on the cheapest supported gadget that iPhone that Apple puts out under the iPhone label. So now, at $399, we've got the iPhone 8 form factor, the slightly smaller form factor, but it's got modern internals. It's got the A13 chipset, and it's got a decent camera, and it's got wireless charging. The line is now consistent moving forward from here. And hopefully that means we're going to see that little bit of a bump into more aggressive software updating for new features and for new capabilities on iPhones starting this year. I still feel like iOS owners, like, if you're on a 10R, you're probably going to get borked for good new features. My iPhone XS seems like it's going to be one of those redheaded stepchild phones that doesn't really get anything new or exciting. I can't even get 16:9 photos in the stock camera, which is really dumb for a phone that cost $1,000 at launch. And because they've got such a great parts bin, Apple can churn out some of these devices and still probably make a crazy profit on how much it costs to make an iPhone SE 2020. So I'm silly excited. I really feel like this is another sea change, like another seismic shift. Just like the first SE was one of my all-time favorite phones that Apple has ever put out. This is already shaping. I'm going into this with, like, the highest of expectations for the cheapest phone that Apple makes. But the thing that has been frustrating and why I feel like tech commentary is so suspect right now.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
How quickly was it before we saw every super mega YouTuber, well, see, now, like, Apple is completely undercutting all of the OnePlus phones. Yeah, I mean, they've got the most powerful processor in a phone, and it's like half the price of a OnePlus 8. Apple just out OnePlus'd OnePlus.
So here's the frustrating bit.
I have zero issues getting intensely excited for the iPhone SE, and that doesn't change the market position for this phone one iota. And it, to me, it brings into stark relief. Like, could not be more clear who is just parroting, just mimicking Apple talking points from their marketing, and who's actually out there testing and reviewing and trying to properly benchmark these devices. You look at an Apple marketing spreadsheet or a bar graph, and it would look like from the iPhone XS to the iPhone 11, we saw a 20% jump in processing power, a 25% bump in graphics processing. And then you go over to Gary Explains and you watch him run speed test G, and the performance delta between the iPhone XS and the iPhone 11 was more like 5%. You can listen to Apple in a marketing keynote put filmmakers on stage and talk about Filmic Pro and making movies on the iPhone and how much better this is for content creators. But then you actually test things like video rendering, and the iPhone 11 was struggling to consistently outperform my LG V30. Not my LG V50, my LG V30. The iPhone 11 Pro mostly beat my LG V30, but it was close, and it still lost a couple performance runs against the LG V30, let alone taking that up against a modern chipset in the LG V50, and let's not even get into, like, the Snapdragon 865. So I have no problem saying the Apple A13 Bionic is the most powerful processor in a mobile device. What I have a problem with is finding opportunities to really leverage that power, and where can we point to real-world conditions that Apple lets developers really dig deep. It's really difficult to point to examples of real-world apps where the developer really gets to max out that A13 Bionic. Even in some of Apple's own software, it's difficult to point to situations where we can realize anywhere near a greater than 5% performance improvement year over year. That, to me, is a conversation in bad faith if we're stopping at Apple's marketing headline. You can get the most powerful processor in a phone for $400, but you can't do anything with it. Apple's not, especially on a $400 phone, Apple's not going to take all the throttling blocks off of that device to let it outperform an iPhone 11 Pro. It's not the same. We can look at some of those other differences. Battery size, battery capacity. We can look at radio management. An iPhone 11 Pro is going to have a 4x4 antenna for better congestion and interference and signal jumping and signal hopping. We know the iPhone SE is rocking that older 2x2 design, which does not perform as well. I don't know about you, but I care about connectivity on my connected devices if I can get good reception. This is so much more nuanced than just Apple good, OnePlus bad. And it's very frustrating because we're now going to be seeing a number of sycophantic commentary and videos pointing this very surface level. A13 is the best. Apple said it was the best. And now you can get that chipset for $400 against, you know, the OnePlus 8, which is too expensive. Wah, 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 wah. When that's not really the reality of how these products are sort of priced against each other. You know, a $699 OnePlus 8 has some serious benefits, has some serious perks to compete against an iPhone 11. That's the price performance comparison ratio right there. If OnePlus makes a light version and it comes back in at like a $300 or $400 phone, that's going to get exciting. Right now, it's looking like TCL. a TCL 10 Pro is going to be $450. I cannot tell you how excited I will be to put the iPhone SE up against the TCL 10 Pro at a $50 price difference, starting price difference. It's actually going to be about the same price when you factor in storage. That's going to be an awesome showdown because those two devices were purpose-built to fight at around the $400 to $500 price tier. I don't see anything in the iPhone SE to suggest to me it will be as premium an experience as a OnePlus 8. And the OnePlus 8 has enough going for it that I can comfortably say a $300 price difference between a OnePlus 8 and an iPhone SE makes sense because those products are targeting different consumers. That's how this works. If you're actually reviewing this stuff in good faith, if you're actually joining this conversation in earnest, it's not hard to be excited about both. From Def Burns 2, the TCL 10 Pro now has a real actual competitor. And we should be excited that that real competitor for the TCL 10 Pro is coming from Apple. Just think about where we're going to be at in this like $400 to $500 tier here in the United States. TCL 10 Pro, iPhone SE, Pixel 5a. Sub $500 phones are going to be monsters this year. That is so intensely competitive and exciting right now. It would be obscene to show you my visage below the waist. I'm just so ridiculously amped for that tier. But that doesn't change here in the United States with all of the shenanigans on 5G and all of the licensing and Qualcomm component pricing and carrier manipulation of the market. Show me another phone with a Snapdragon 865 and a 5G radio that comes in cheaper than a OnePlus 8. So far, the only one we can kind of point to is ZTE. And right now, it doesn't look like it's going to support 5G on any carriers. Maybe some 5G support for what AT&T is talking about, and I still can't buy it. Like, it still doesn't really exist here in the United States. Looks like it's going to be an awesome phone. Doesn't really exist here yet. We'll have one, maybe two phones at $700 with a Snapdragon 865 and 5G. That, to me, sounds like it's OnePlus's territory to win. Like they're winning that segment right now. There is no competition for OnePlus at $700 that I can find. And so, like, you know, Q3 Becker and Kyle Ruggers are saying, like, hey, it doesn't make sense to me. I'm looking at OnePlus 7T is a lot cheaper. I mean, what, you can find a OnePlus 7T for $450? Is that the starting price for a 7T? But again, if one of the arguments of a OnePlus device is that they support their phones for 3 years of software updates, and we know that especially in more urban and dense, population-dense markets, that 5G is already being signal-swapped on towers, I feel now is a good time to look at your long-term usage. If you're the type of person who's going to flip a phone every 6 months, yeah, it's not going to matter to you. Get the 7T, flip it when you're ready. But for the people out there, like most of the members of my family who are holding on to phones for 3 and 4 years, even past, long past software end of life, it might matter. They get into year three of their smartphone ownership and they fire up 5G in Albuquerque, New Mexico. That means they don't have to buy a new phone to get 5G because they've always had it. You know, again, I think it's a little short-sighted to make a broad, no one cares about LTE. I mean, no one cares about 5G. LTE is good enough. When we know that over the next couple years, cell phone carriers are going to start redirecting more of their bandwidth to the 5G devices to make them more desirable. I know the marketing is like, oh, well, no, LTE and 5G are totally going to interoperate. Everything's going to be just fine. You're not going to notice any differences. But we're not seeing backhaul pointed towards LTE towers like when LTE first started. And when we went from 3G to 4G, 3G speeds took a hit as LTE speeds improved. And I feel very confident in saying that carriers are probably going to mess with us again in about 2 years, where the majority of the bandwidth that they're going to dedicate to newer devices supersedes the devices that are legacy, that are on 3G and 4G spectrum. So I feel like now is a decent time for some populations, again, people living in some regions, to more seriously be considering 5G. I don't think it brings anything special to the table for speed. I think that's all a conversation on backhaul. But 5G does bring some benefits to radio management and congestion. So you find clear air easier. That's not bad. That's a pretty decent perk. It could be nice when 5G rolls out in your area. And when we've seen some of the improvements to Sprint, if you've been on Sprint and you find yourself in a 5G area, you have a real smartphone again. not this terrible, like, you know, 5 meg download speed that I got for most of my LTE usage in Sprint in my neck of the woods. So that to me is worth commenting on. We can all acknowledge that Qualcomm is burning us for component pricing, but if we're looking at comparative performance, price performance, and where OnePlus fits into this ecosystem, I still can't find a better buy than the OnePlus 8. So again, someone please drop it in my comments here if I'm missing a phone. But if you want the top of the line premium chipset, a 90 hertz refresh rate display, and you're concerned about the longevity of that device supporting a future technology like 5G, there is a consumer out there who exists who cares about that criteria from a company with a solid track record of updating their devices on a timely timetable, not always the fastest, but consistent software support for around 3 years of product. Show me a device that's cheaper, because I can't find it. From Kapakash, 5G will be great when people stop burning towers. Oh, man. Yeah, it's pretty freaky. It's true. From Def Burns, I'm trying to get my girlfriend onto a OnePlus, but the phones are just too big. I don't know that we'll see 5G in a smaller phone because of some of those longevity and battery concerns. Like, you need to start with more capacity on the battery because of the extra power draw. I mean, that's just going to be the reality for, I don't know, I'd say comfortably through 2021 until we start getting on chipset radio management, you know, like we had back with LTE. And I think it's going to take a bit. The antenna arrays on 5G phones are going to be ridiculous for the next couple of years. It's going to be a while before I think we've got true, unlocked, all carrier supported kinds of devices. Carriers are loving 5G for all of this lock-in. You know, I can't take my V50 over to another carrier and have it work the same, it's going to instantly fall back at best to being an LTE device. That's going to be a really frustrating aspect of this transition. And from Kyle Ruggles, there's a lot of settling with OnePlus now, big phone, curved screens, high prices for Canadians. And again, I'm coming at this in the United States, and they're still kind of treating us well here, OnePlus in the USA. But again, this is why I feel like the conversation has... The frustrating thing about the OnePlus conversation isn't that, you know, OnePlus is walking away from the enthusiast market. Every time I can bring this up, go watch Tech Alter's video on enthusiast brands. Enthusiast brands cannot sustain profitability. You're always going to lose if you only go for the brands that start out by saying nice things about the tiniest, angriest, most vocal demographic in smartphone ownership. If that's your gig, you are in for a lifetime of betrayal and disappointment. You only should be caring about competition. Are these products getting more competitive? And between a renewed interest in mid-rangers, the Snapdragon 700 series being a phenomenal chipset for mid-ranger devices, and this 5G transition being so clumsy, the OnePlus 8 still represents the exact same mission that every other OnePlus has before. OnePlus 6, OnePlus 7, what do you have? You have a phone that is roughly two-thirds the cost of a premium Galaxy or a premium iPhone and is competitive for a handful of compromises. That has always been the OnePlus mission. They sold $400 phones when people were selling $600 phones. Now they're selling a $700 phone when Samsung is starting at $1,000. They have not missed a step. OnePlus is still eyes on target, exactly in the same conversation they have always been in. The industry has moved. The industry has hiked up a very expensive hill. OnePlus still represents the exact same conversation they've always represented. It's just you can't get around how expensive these new component costs are. That's the gig. Ugh. So from Chatty Boy 3, OnePlus 7T or a OnePlus 8? So for myself personally, and again, I'm going to air a little bit of dirty laundry here. I am not sure what happened with my relationship with OnePlus. I got an email back in March saying, hey, we're going to be putting out some review devices. I knew I wasn't going to be on the embargo, but they were saying, hey, do you want to review the phone? And I emailed back and said, sure. And then my contact at OnePlus left the company and set me up with just two other people to follow up with. And I sent them an email. And now I'm starting to get a little worried. We're a couple days before the actual official launch of the phone, and I've not heard back from anyone at OnePlus, my old contact or these new people. I sent them another message. And it turns out, it seems that for some reason my email was listed as spam on the OnePlus email server, so no communication. I'm probably not getting review devices or anything from OnePlus. So when the phones go on sale, I think I'm going to pick up a OnePlus 8. But it really, it's gutting for me because this is always some of my favorite commentary to dig into. OnePlus is such a unique conversation in the smartphone market, and this is a formative year for OnePlus. I think the OnePlus 7 represented their first foray into true flagship style positioning, and now they're continuing on that. And yet, even with their true flagship pricing, they represent a cap at $1,000, where Samsung starts at $1,000. The LG V60 slots right in between the OnePlus 8 and the OnePlus 8 Pro. There are so many amazing comparisons to be had, and I'm going to be way late. All of my coverage is basically dead now. It's really a frustrating situation to be in, because I will go hands-on with a OnePlus 8. I don't know that I'm going to go hands-on with the OnePlus 8 Pro, but I'm going to work my ass off, and I know that I'm going to get a fraction of the viewership, of the sharing, and of course that also means ad revenue, that I would have gotten for the same amount of work if this email situation hadn't manifested the way that it was. So, Chatty Boy, that was a really long-winded way back around to a OnePlus 7T or OnePlus 8. I would probably lean towards the OnePlus 8 because I care about things like the horsepower and the heavy lifting. And the Snapdragon 865 is representing a pretty decent upgrade for the stuff that I do over the 855 Plus. So the chipset in the OnePlus 7T is no slouch. That phone is a screamer. And today, if you're just looking at a phone to cover the basics as an average consumer, I'm not bothered in the slightest by a recommendation for the OnePlus 7T. The OnePlus 7T did not represent the best multimedia or content creation platform of last year. I have a video putting the 7T up against the V50, the Pixel 4, and the ROG 2, and different chipsets, so 855 and 855 Plus, different file systems, EXT and F2FS, and different Android operating systems, Android 9. At the time, I think my V50 was Android 9, but Android 9 versus Android 10. And the OnePlus 7T got smoked by every other phone on the table, and the Pixel 4 destroyed the V50 and the ROG2. I want that kind of power in a OnePlus phone. So I'm very positive on the OnePlus 8 for the things that I do. So if it's on me, then my pick would be flip the OnePlus 7T and get a OnePlus 8. I know it, the price performance is better for the OnePlus 7T, but I do this stuff on phones. I need that power on phones. And when I can realize some stupid gains, I mean, like on the V, from the V50 to the V60, some of those performance deltas were in marketing bullet points. When Qualcomm said there was like a 20% boost to certain types of processing, I can realize that. Like 15 to 20% improvements in video rendering. How much do you pay in PC hardware to realize a 20% improvement in 4K video rendering? Because I got that on my V60, and the V60 cost less than the V50 at launch. I am on board a $700 OnePlus giving me that kind of horsepower. Matt Tyler, I'll try to get a OnePlus 8 Pro and I'll hook you up. Aw, thanks, man. I can't tell you again. I don't like airing my dirty laundry, or just, I've had such a good working relationship with OnePlus over the years. And the person who's stepping down from their PR team is like, we've been to trade shows together for years. You know, it's a water cooler work buddy. And I'm like, of course, one of their biggest launches, that's when my email is giving me issues and I'm not getting any replies or anything from them. And it's coming right on top of the iPhone SE launch. It's coming right on top. I'm hoping that we're getting some more word on the TCL. By the time I can circle back to this phone, my SEO is wrecked. No one is going to be searching for this. The conversation is being manipulated by voices in tech reviewing that I think are totally suspect now. I couldn't be more upset about not jumping on this this generation of OnePlus. I want to like flip tables over, and it like just such impotent rage on my part. So that's the OnePlus conversation and story there. I kind of sidetracked myself into feeling sorry for myself again. Let's wrap just the gadget block up on the one big bright positive. If you're an iOS user out there, or you are helping to support maybe, say, like a legacy iOS user, to me, it's almost an instant buy recommendation before I have the phone in my hands. I am very confident there are going to be some compromises. I am very confident it's not going to outperform more expensive devices. And honestly, none of that matters for the iPhone SE. I look at what phone would I recommend for my grandmother, who's on, I think she's on an older, she's on an iPhone 7. I don't think she's going to like gesture home button. Like her older hands swiping to go home to her app lists again doesn't make sense to me. She is a battle axe on her iPad, and she's capable on her iPhone. I have a phone I can replace my grandmother's iPhone 7 with. And it's not going to break the bank. That just makes me so happy. I'm sure you have grandparents, parents, aunts, uncles who are maybe holding on to some older iPhones. And now we have a solution. We have an option to get them current. That is the most exciting aspect of Apple playing with this SE experiment again. Why I loved the original iPhone SE and why I'm so happy for this next iPhone SE. I think we're going to see some drift. Obviously, there are going to be a bunch of Android users who are going to look at this and see, this is my way to get in into the iOS ecosystem. I'll finally have the correct color bubble when I'm in group chat with my other iPhone friends. Sure, whatever flex you need to have for that. But a $400 phone covering the basics, the security is going to be better if you find yourself wearing masks when you're out and about. There is so much that I am critically positive for this iPhone SE. So that'll probably end up being the next sort of stage of gadget commentary. It's going to be some fun fights around this lower mid-range market. So I'm really stoked there. I want to end on something positive for the gadget block, and that's honestly what I'm positive about. So we're going to wrap this up before this podcast becomes another 3-hour marathon. I do have a couple freebies. I unfortunately did not dig as deep this week as we did last week. Last week, you can still get that special for the PlayStation. My wife, this is super cool. My wife is not a hardcore gamer. We play a ton of Boggle. She likes, you know, like draw and connect dot games, Jewel, Gem Swap, things like that. You know, very casual gamer. Last night, my wife started firing up Drake's Uncharted. We're getting her in. Third person adventure gaming. The promo was you could get Drake's for free on the PS4 and Journey. You could get Drake's and Journey. So I think tonight we're going to try Journey and just see if she likes that kind of more, fantasy twist to a game. So excited. So excited. She almost rage quit during the early missions where she was jumping and trying to get Drake to catch on to the ledges of different rock outcroppings, but she stuck with it for a while. And she's playing on the lowest explorer setting. So she's taking bullets like crazy. You know, she's basically invulnerable in this action movie, but we're starting. I'm starting to get her lit up on some other types of gameplay. And from Root Night 5, Journey is not a game. It's a spiritual cleansing. Oh, that's hilarious. So, but again, I think my wife might be more interested in some other alternative, you know, like again, fantasy and exploration and less about like, dual pistols and stuff like that. So anyway, some of those other freebies we talked about last week are still game. Radiohead putting out concert series. This one was super cool. Netflix is moving a bunch of their documentaries and short films over to YouTube. This was written up by Christine Fisher over at Engadget. To help teachers and students learning from home during the situation, Netflix is making a handful of documentaries available for free on its Netflix US YouTube channel. At the moment, there are 10 documentary films and series available, including 13th, Babies, Chasing Coral, Knock Down the House, and Our Planet. So what's also kind of cool about this, Netflix gave up on community commentary when they started becoming more of a streaming service. I used to love going through the comments on Netflix titles, you know, especially back in the DVD rental days. Moving these over to YouTube affords us a terrible space, but at least some kind of public community commenting space where people could engage in some kind of discussion about that content. So those documentaries are already moving over. You can catch that over on the YouTube, on the Netflix YouTube channel. And another one, following in the footsteps of Radiohead last week, where Radiohead is going to start re-releasing concerts. You can stream full concerts, and I love that kind of organic live sound that you can get from a good concert recording. Pink Floyd is going to be doing the same. So this is from consequenceofsound.net, written up by Alex Young. This started last week, but they're streaming a 1995 concert, Pulse. And it's already available on, I definitely can't click on anything in this video or I'll get an immediate copyright strike, but you can already stream this concert from 1995. And just again, an amazingly good high quality concert recording, and it's available for free. So, really good times. And again, I want to thank people out there who've been kind of sending me some recommendations. Keep on the lookout for services like Good Old Games, the Epic Game Launcher. PlayStation has a new Play at Home initiative We're seeing more free games coming out to the ecosystem. We're seeing more free movies coming out. What was the documentary I caught on YouTube? It was the sequel to Super Size Me. So I don't know if you remember that documentary, Super Size Me. Morgan Spurlock made a follow-up to that. And their initial release, they actually made a free version available on YouTube. So you can also catch that. I mean, again, we're seeing some really creative ways to try and distribute content, especially for things that would have maybe been more of a theatrical release or would have had some other type of big public fanfare. I'm happy to see some smarter community-focused but online stay-at-home kinds of initiatives. So, folks, that's going to do it. We're going to wrap up this episode and doing pretty close to my normal 2 hour 20 kind of a podcast. But as always, I want to wrap this all up. Every week I come into these conversations with a community that is fun and engaging. I love this live chat, and it's kind of the fuel I need to kick off my week. On that personal note, as we're facing challenges that we've never faced before, as we've never been more separated, it is encouraging and it is empowering to know that though we are separated, we are not divided. And I thank each and every one of you who joins me on this journey and joins these conversations and is the good tech neighbor. You are the good tech citizen, and you are that resource for your family and friends to make sure that they're better informed and better protected. So I want you to have an amazing week with your technology. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. And I'll catch you back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat on the SGGQA podcast channel. Be well, take care, stay safe. I love you all, and I'll catch you back.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs, is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.